What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. Recording this on Monday, June 2nd, and the NBA Finals are set. We had Indiana and Oklahoma City clinch their conference final series over the past week. And so I'm going to talk through those series, the Knicks and Pacers and the Wolves and Thunder, and you know how those played out, why they were able to win, and the outlook for the losing teams moving forward and where they go from here. Not going to do a full preview of the finals in this pod because I'm going to have a fully dedicated podcast for that to talk through all the nuances of that. But of course, going to do full recaps of the conference finals on this one. So with that being said, let's go ahead and get right into it. So starting in the East, the Indiana Pacers are going to the NBA Finals. They defeated the Knicks in six games over this past weekend. They were underdogs going into this series, but stole game one and game two in New York before being up 3-1, heading back to New York in game five. The Knicks predictably won game five in what was more of a desperation, adrenaline type game, similar to what we saw from the Celtics in their game five going back home when they were down 3-1. But the Pacers on Saturday night were able to knock off the Knicks 125-108 in what was a dominant second half in which Halliburton took over. Nembhard was just phenomenal defensively guarding Brunson. And in this series, the Pacers were just the better team across the board. I think a lot of people, myself included, thought the Knicks were on paper more talented. I know they're not as deep, but in terms of just star power across the board, some of the key top rotation guys on their roster, I think a lot of people thought the Knicks on paper should win this series. But the proof is in the pudding. Indiana has just looked like the best team, not only in this series, but in the Eastern Conference throughout this whole postseason. And of course, they are led by Tyrese Halliburton, who put himself on the map in this series and on this playoff run if he was not already there. But he averaged 21 points, 11 assists, 6 rebounds, shot 46% from the field. In Halliburton fashion, he was a little bit up and down in this series. He had a bit of a stinker game five, but you know, 31 points and 11 assists with a buzzer beater in game one to send it to overtime is about as good as it gets. Game four was probably one of the most flawless postseason games I've ever seen someone play. 32 points, 15 assists, 12 rebounds, 4 steals, and not a single turnover. I mean, he was just spectacular. It was peak Halliburton at his best. And then in game six, 21, 13, and 6 took over down the stretch of the second half and really just dictated the pace of the series, dominated offensively. I actually thought he really held up well defensively in this series as well. I thought a key thing that the Knicks could have done to exploit Indiana was to attack Halliburton one-on-one in switches, but they didn't really do a lot of that. And when they did, Halliburton held up just fine. I mean, they had him on Mikal Bridges for the majority of the series. They even had him guarding OG Anunoby at times. But those guys were not really able to take much advantage. It's not like they had particularly big series, and they just did not take advantage of that matchup at all. And I also thought he did a really good job of just being in the right spots and rotating well as a help defender. And he had a ton of steals in the series, which obviously that's a big way that Indiana generates points, is in the fast break off of turnovers. And so he was a big part of forcing those and then in turn getting easier offense as well. But look, I've been as big of a Halliburton guy as anybody. He really, really struggled to start this season. And that was coming off a second half last year in which he just didn't quite look like the same version of himself. A lot of people put that on that hamstring injury that he had in the second half of last season, thought that maybe he rushed back because he wanted to hit the 65 minimum mark to be eligible for all NBA. And maybe he was compromised after that, but then he didn't play much in the Olympics. And to start this season, he looked like the not that good version of himself. I even had a segment on one of my sample size roulette podcasts saying, is the sample size big enough to say that Halliburton's just not that good? And I did not go that far. I said, you know, I've seen him and what he looks like at his best, and it is just one of the most dominant offensive players that we have in the NBA. And he's so unique because he dictates so much offensively without being a ball dominant guy. He didn't even lead this team in usage rate during the regular season. And we see so many other guys like him that are so impactful on the offensive end, but they all really need the ball to have that impact. They're more heliocentric offensive players, but he is not that. He is somehow able to, you know, dominate the pace, to manipulate the defense, to just be such a dominant offensive force without having the ball in his hands 24/7. And that's what makes him so unique, and that's what makes him so great and impactful, and he empowers his teammates. And that's why they are where they are right now. And I think he's legitimately pushing to be a top 10 player in the league right now. We can argue over semantics of 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, whatever, but the point is he's in that range. And being the best player on a finals team is a ridiculous accomplishment. It is so difficult to do. I mean, if you just look in the league right now, how many players have accomplished that? LeBron, Steph, and KD. SGA obviously just made it in the West this year. Kawhi, Giannis, Tatum, Jimmy Butler, Jokic, Luka. And then I think for the 21 Suns team, you'd probably have to say Chris Paul was the best player on that team, even though Booker was the first option. But so if you look at guys that are in their prime that have done it, it's really just SGA, Giannis, Tatum, Jokic, Luka, and now Halliburton. So that's a really exclusive group. And I just want to say that it's really hard to make the finals no matter the circumstances. And so he has cemented himself as, you know, a premier player in this league, one of the best guards in the entire NBA. And I do think he's in that top 10 conversation. Additionally, I really think he should have won MVP in this. I think Siakam was awesome, but I just think that Halliburton is so paramount to everything that Indiana is doing. He is this system. He makes the Pacers what they are. I think his impact trumps anything that Siakam did in this series. I think the argument for Siakam obviously is obvious. He shot the ball a little better than Halliburton, was the leading scorer on the team. But if you just look at the Pacers' wins in this series, which of course that's kind of how you should measure value, because in the games that they lose, it doesn't really matter how well Halliburton played because they lost those games. You know what I mean? So in the four wins, he averaged 25 points a game, 13 assists, 8 rebounds, 2.5 steals, only 2 turnovers. And so the stats were there for him on top of just the impact that we know he has and the nuances of what he does for this team. So I think Siakam was a worthy MVP, but I do just think that it's a little bit of a, you know, naive take to think that Halliburton is not clearly the most valuable player on this team and the number one reason by a mile that they're in this position. So I did just want to call that out, but I don't want to take anything away from Siakam because he was spectacular in this series as well. A, you know, deserving MVP. It's not one of those where I'm like, this is totally ridiculous. Like, he played well enough to get that award, but 25 points per game in this series on 52% from the field, 50% from three, which is just an area of massive improvement for him. He was great in the regular season there, great in the postseason so far across the board. He basically single-handedly won them game two in this series with 39 points in a game that, you know, nobody could really score for Indiana or New York. I mean, he was the only guy that really had it going across the board, and he really took them to that victory, and that was a huge win for them, obviously going up 2-0, winning both games in New York. And then he had 30 in game four, 31 in game six, so he was awesome in their wins, just like Halliburton was. And I thought he was kind of an X factor for them. He was so just rock solid in this series. I mean, he does so much for them on both ends of the court. He guarded Towns for a ton of the series because Turner had some foul trouble at points throughout this series and also just wasn't the most effective on the defensive end. And they don't have a lot of reinforcements after him in terms of big men. on this roster with all the injuries they've had to that position. And so Siakam was thrust into playing a lot of small ball five, having to guard Towns, having to guard Mitchell Robinson at times as well. And I thought he just did an awesome job, a much better job than Turner did, who was getting abused a little bit by Towns throughout the series, particularly when he was getting downhill to the basket. But aside from just his defense, I mean, Siakam, when Halliburton's not in, he is the main source of creation for this group, which is super impressive for a guy at his position. The versatility he has on both ends of the court is so invaluable to this team. And he's really become a deadly transition player, which wasn't a huge part of his game in Toronto. They played a lot more half court offense, but his game is totally flourished in this system in terms of just when they get the ball, he is sprinting down that court and he knows Halliburton's going to find him. And so he had so many just, I mean, off of made baskets too. It wasn't even just off of misses or forced turnovers or anything like that. Like, he was such a force for them in transition in this series. And it's a huge part of why they won. And I just think that Siakam is so underrated in this era. He's a multi-time All-NBA guy. He's now making these finals for the second time in his career as the clear-cut number two option on a team, which is really hard to do. And if, God forbid, they win the finals, which, of course, it's going to be a little bit of an uphill battle for them against a team as dominant as OKC. But if they were to do it, he would be the only player since the merger in NBA history to be the clear-cut number two option on two finals teams with two different teams. It has never been done. We've seen a lot of number twos win multiple times, but it's always been with the same franchise, in the same core, in the same group. Or it's been a scenario where maybe they were a number one place and then they won it as a number two somewhere else. Or there was debate over who is the one versus two. But in terms of just a clear-cut Robin on a championship team, a clear-cut second-best player, Siakam would be the only player to accomplish that. Which, again, that's just so impressive. And I think he is going to be looked at fondly. And I hope he gets the credit that he deserves when he does eventually retire or start to decline or whatever, because he has been such a just rock solid, impactful, all NBA level talent in the NBA for a while now. But aside from the top two guys, they got a ton of contributions because that's what the Pacers do. You know, they're deep as hell. Their role players are so paramount to what they are doing as a team and as a unit. Particularly Nesmith and Nembhard were great for them at different times throughout this series. I mean, Nesmith, he was really the only one that could even remotely bother Brunson for most of this series. He was pretty comfortably getting his, especially in the early games of the series. It looked like Indiana just did not have anybody that could get him out of his spots or, you know, make things difficult for him. But Nesmith was really the only one that was able to do that even a little bit. Obviously, that ankle injury did affect him to a degree. But still, he is so active defensively. The way he fights over screens is as good as anybody in the league. He gets in your chest. I mean, he was picking up full court, which that's what you need to do against a team like the Knicks with Brunson, who is so ball dominant, and just you need to put wear and tear on him to tire him out for as the series goes on. And that's pretty much exactly what happened by game six. He was a little flustered down the stretch, Jalen Brunson. But he's also sneakily become just an awesome shooter. I mean, game one, I don't have to tell you about that one. He basically single-handedly won that, goes 8 for 9 from three, hits 6 straight threes late in that one to help send it to overtime. But he was 53% from three in this series. He's 42% from three over the last 2 years on decent volume, you know, around 4 a game. So he's just been an elite shooter. He's not talked about a lot in that sort of list of great shooters across the league, but the numbers are there. He has developed himself into that. And honestly, like, coming out of college from Vanderbilt, he was viewed as an elite shooter. That was his number one calling card. And so to see him now having that come to fruition in the NBA is not super surprising. But he's also not just a shooter. He can attack off the closeouts. He's a great cutter. He has developed a little bit of a nice little mid-range game when he does attack off that closeout. And then Nembhard, you know, he had some pretty rough games. Game 3, 4, and 5 were just not good for him. It was looking like his playoff magic had sort of run its course, but he was obviously great in game 1 and 2, and they don't win those games without him playing well. But he also really could not guard Brunson for all their playoff matchup last year and for most of this series. But game 6, he it's like he overcame his demons. Something happened to him, and suddenly he was just wreaking havoc against Brunson and really got him out of his rhythm, especially with Neesmith a little banged up. They switched over to have Nembhard guard him again, and he took over against him. I mean, he really, really bothered him down the stretch. He was picking up him full court. He was causing turnovers. Brunson had 5 turnovers in this game. He was wildly negative on the offensive end. If you look at the stats, 94 offensive rating in this game, only 2 for 7 from downtown, 8 of 18 from the field. But he just wasn't as impactful as we had seen him be throughout most of the series. And also Nembhard finally hits a big shots in game 6. You know, he got the rhythm back and it's actually still ended up with 44% from 3 for the series. And very sneakily, he has the second best career playoff 3-point percentage in NBA history with 49%. So just a little fun nugget there. But then Miles Turner was rock solid as usual. You know, there were some things in this series that he struggled with, particularly on the defensive end, did not rebound the ball well, but he did enough offensively to still be a contributor and a big body out there. Obi Toppin, TJ McConnell, Ben Shepherd all contributed across the board, had their ups and downs, but you know, they were still having positive impacts at different points of this series. Ben Mathurin and Jairus Walker were out of the rotation at the beginning of this series, but ended up being, you know, thrown out there when they were struggling in games 3, 4, and 5 at times. And they had a huge impact. You know, Mathurin scored 20 in game 4, 23 in game 5, was instant offense for them off the bench down the stretch of this series. Jairus Walker, I thought, gave some really good two-way minutes in this series as well, especially when they had to go small ball with Tony Bradley getting hurt. And then obviously Miles Turner had some foul trouble and wasn't super effective at times. Jairus Walker did get hurt and reportedly is going to miss the first 2 games of the finals, which is unfortunate. But I've always been a Walker guy since his draft, and I still think he can be a really good contributor for this team. And lastly, I want to talk about Rick Carlisle, because I really can't compliment him enough for his performance, not only in this series, but in this playoff run, in last year's playoff run. And he's just a damn good coach, and I don't think he gets talked about enough. You know, all of his adjustments basically hit in this series. The way that they switched up coverages on Brunson just continued to have an effect on him as the series went on. The switch from Thomas Bryant to Tony Bradley back to Thomas Bryant was obviously a big move, because Bradley was just a bigger body that could defend Mitchell Robinson and box out a little better than Bryant could, who was rough in the first few games. But then obviously Bryant hit some huge threes in game 6. Mathurin and Walker, like I mentioned, their increased minutes, I think, definitely had a positive impact and switched up some looks for them. And look, this is now his second finals. He already has a championship back in 2011 with the Dallas Mavericks. He's now made 5 conference finals across 4 different teams and 3 franchises. So very impressive number there. And I think the best thing about him is that he's so malleable. He adjusts to the style of every team that he's had. You know, back in his early days with the Pistons, and then even with those early Pacers teams he had, those were very defense-driven teams. You know, that was their calling card. They were defense first, and then whatever they could get out of the offense. Then he goes to Dallas, and he builds an offense around the best shooting stretch, you know, big or 4-man, whatever you want to call Dirk, that we've probably ever seen. And they win a championship with that mold. Then once Dirk phases out and they draft Luka, they suddenly now have an offense around a heliocentric, ISO heavy, slower pace with Luka Doncic. And we all know that that's sort of when he's at his best, is when he can slow the game down and pick apart the defense. Then he gets to Indiana again and has a totally different team with Haliburton. Then Siakam comes in last year, and they have this heavy motion, high pace, win the turnover battle, like get everybody involved, depth, just high powered offense, which is just so different from every other team he's had. And so to see him just be able to mold his style and system to whatever his team has is something that's really impressive. And I think a lot of times when we get frustrated with coaches, it's because they will not deviate from their philosophy. But the best part about Carlisle is he doesn't really have a built-in philosophy. His philosophy is whatever the personnel in front of him dictates. And that's what makes him so great. And He is sneakily crawling up the rankings for best coaches of all time. You know, he's 11th all time in wins, 10th all time in playoff wins. Especially with this finals, I think he should be a shoe-in for the Hall of Fame. And I'd honestly go as far as to say that I think there's really only four coaches you could definitively say are above him in this era, you know, in this century, the 2000s NBA. And that'd be Eric Spoelstra, Greg Popovich, Steve Kerr, and then Phil Jackson, who obviously has been retired for a while, but they did have a good amount of overlap back when he was with the Lakers in the early 2010s, late 2000s. So, but after those four, you know, I think Carlisle is right there, and I'd probably have him next, and you could probably debate a few other guys, but I just think he's that good, and I think he's one of the best coaches of this generation. But obviously the Pacers pretty much outplayed the Knicks for the most part in the series, but I really think they won this in game one because that comeback was probably one of the most ridiculous and absurd things I've ever seen in a basketball series. They never die. I've been saying this for a long time. I've been tweeting it every time they've had these absurd comebacks, but they just win these improbable games. This is the third one of the postseason now, and this was probably the most insane of all. You know, Brunson hits a three with just under 3 minutes to go up 14 points, and they end regulation on a 20-6 run to end regulation. Nesmith goes 6-for-6 from three in the final 5 minutes. Haliburton hits one of the most ridiculous, almost game winners, but ends up being a game-tying buzzer beater to send to overtime that I've ever seen. Goes to overtime. You know, the Pacers finish overtime on a 13-6 run. And again, this game, I just think, set the tone for the series. It gave the Pacers confidence, not that they necessarily needed it, but just reinforces that confidence that they already had. It took away some of the Knicks' confidence, I thought. You know, the fans were a little on edge in game two because it feels like much more of a must-win. The Pacers were kind of playing with house money, and they were still able to win that game two. And it just feels like this was the swing game in this series, and the Knicks were just never able to recover from there. The Pacers overall, they're one of the most unlikely finals teams probably that we've had in a while. I was as high on them as pretty much anybody. I picked them to beat the Cavaliers to make the Eastern Conference Finals for the second year in a row. But I did not see this coming. You know, I didn't really think making the finals was on the board for them when the postseason started. I think probably the two Heat teams that made the finals in 2020 and 2023 are probably the most comparable in terms of, like, I don't think anybody really saw those teams making, especially not in 2023 when they were an 8 seed. But other than them, it's kind of been a while since to think of a team that was more improbable than this team. Just coming in from like an odds perspective, expectations, you know, I think probably, I mean, everybody would have had Boston ahead of them, New York, the Cavs, and then probably a lot of people probably would have still said Milwaukee had not necessarily would beat them in the first round, but had a better chance to make the finals just because of the Giannis factor. And this was Dame was healthy going into the postseason, et cetera. But this, even with all that, this does not feel like a fluke. It doesn't feel like they got lucky. Like, they deserve every bit of this. They deserve the credit for this run. They were simply the best team in the East. I mean, they took down Giannis, the best player in the conference. They destroyed the Cavs, who were a 64-win team. I know they were banged up, but that series, from a competitive standpoint, just was not close. And then they beat the Knicks, who were also favored against them and one of the preseason favorites alongside Boston coming into the year. And so they, as far as I'm concerned, deserve every bit of this. They look like the best team in the East. And again, they are now 52-21 in their last 73 games. That's 58 win pace. And again, that's almost a full season sample size. So this shouldn't be surprising. You take out the first 25 games of the season and they basically played at a near 60 win pace. So it's not like this team was some massive, massive underdog. They've got the talent. They were in the conference finals last year. They've, for the better part of almost a full season, played at an elite level. And so that's why they're in the finals. They're as good of a full cohesive team as we have in the league right now. And it's just cool to see a team that's so fun to watch, that plays in such a unique fashion, get all the way there and actually knock off the Knicks. On the New York side of things, there's a lot of reasons why they lost this series. I think defense was probably the number one factor. They just really could not figure out how to guard Indiana. I think game five was really the exception. They did bother them a bit in that game. And even in game two, they did a little bit except for Siakam. But obviously, that's a huge part of what Indiana does is have Pascal Siakam be involved. But I thought the pace threw them off. The transition defense for them was just awful down the stretch of this series. They could not get them out of their flow at all. And the constant movement for Indiana did not really allow for the Knicks to, you know, hide anybody. Like for the Knicks, you can just throw someone on Josh Hart and it's not a big deal. You know, he's not going to like burn you on the offensive end, but Indiana doesn't really have anybody like that. You want to put someone on Nesmith? That dude is constantly moving. He's constantly cutting. He's a threat to shoot from outside. He can get to the basket a little bit. Like he's involved in their screening all the time. Like it's not an easy cover. You're going to be involved in the action if you're guarding anybody in this starting five rotation. And I actually think the number one thing that killed them defensively was Brunson. He obviously was spectacular offensively. I mean, he averaged 30.7 points per game, almost six assists, shot 50% from the field. He had 62% true shooting. So, look, he was great on the offensive end. There's no debating that. But I really thought the Pacers looked like a different team with him on the court versus when he was off the court. The team had a 123 defensive rating when Brunson was on the court. And that was the worst among anyone in New York's nine-man rotation. And that was opposed to 106 defensive rating with him off the court. So that's a 17-point swing in terms of defensive rating with Brunson was on or off the court, which, I mean, that's arguably the series right there. Like when he was out there, Indiana could not be stopped. And when he was off the court, Indiana really struggled to score. And I actually really think, which it sounds crazy saying this, I think Brunson's defensive shortcomings in this series almost offset his offensive impact. I actually think he, in some ways, was a negative overall in this series, just because I think that what he didn't do defensively almost was more impactful in the series than what he did do offensively. Because, look, the team was a minus 8.5 with him on the court, and they were a plus 16.1 with him off the court. So that's a 25-point swing right now. I mean, they were consistently winning the minutes he was not on the court, and they are just consistently losing by a good bit when he was on the court. And some of the biggest runs for the Knicks came with him on the bench. You know, game one, they go in a 14-0 run in the fourth quarter when he gets his fifth foul, and then they build this lead up, which they then blow once he comes back in the game. Fourth quarter of game three, obviously a super important game for them. They can't go down 0-3. They go on an 11-4 run to start the fourth quarter, build up a lead after trailing, and they maintain that lead with Brunson out of the game before winning that one down the stretch. Then they go on an 18-11 run to start the second quarter in game five to build that lead from 4-11. And then the Pacers never got two single digits again the rest of the game. So a lot of the big runs that they had that sort of decided this series were when Brunson was not on the court. And he now, for his last two postseasons, has a 121 defensive rating. Last year, he was a 117 offensive rating, 125 defensive rating. He's been negative over the last 2 years now. So this is clearly a trend. And I especially thought in game one, in that swing game that, you know, I think a lot of people think decided this series, him having foul trouble just killed them. Because when he was out there with those five fouls, he was so scared to get a sixth foul. He played soft defensively. He wouldn't even contest shots on a lot of possessions. And Indiana was attacking him, going right at him. I mean, the Pacers had 147 offensive rating when in Brunson's 38 minutes in game one. Like that, you're not going to win a lot of games when your best player is just that easy to score on. And of course, it's not all his fault. But if you watch the game, I mean, they're going right at him and he was playing just not with the level of contest and force on the defensive end that they needed him to play within that game because he was so scared to foul out. And I get it, but I really think that that cost them. And I even think if he had played hard defensively, even if he did foul out, they still could have won that game. And so Brunson, obviously, like I said, spectacular offensively in this series, but I just feel like the defensive shortcomings outweighed his offensive impact, and he was a real issue for them in this series. And another reason why they weren't able to hide him is because he's got to play a lot of minutes with Karl Anthony Towns. And I think this series was sort of a microcosm of Towns' career because on one hand, look, the guy averaged 25 and 12 on 61% true shooting. Doesn't get much better than that for a center. And not a single player on the Pacers could really guard him when he was determined to get downhill. He was an issue for Indiana when he wanted to get to the basket, and they didn't have an answer for it. He really carried them in the non-Brunson minutes. They were a plus 10 net rating when Towns was on the court and Brunson was off the court. So those were big minutes. I mean, he was super impactful in this series overall, and he single-handedly won game three for them. You know, he had 20 points and 8 rebounds in just the fourth quarter of that game. He was a plus 14 in 11 minutes. They outscored them 36-20 in the fourth to go from trailing to then winning that game. And Brunson played only 2.5 minutes in the fourth. So he really willed them to that game. And I thought that was one of the best stretches of basketball of his entire career, especially given the stakes in the moment. But on the other hand, he had more turnovers than assists in this series, which has been a trend for him in the postseason. He had foul trouble in multiple games, with almost all of them being dumb fouls, because that's just what he does. He was consistently attacked on the defensive end, and by the end of the series, all the discourse coming out, the Now They Tell Us article dropped by The Athletic, all of it says that he's essentially being used as the scapegoat, and that they need to trade him in order to, you know, get over the hump here. And so he's just such a polarizing player. He's been a scapegoat for a while. He was with Minnesota as well. I think this in particular series, it's really hard to blame him. I actually think he was probably their most consistent player, especially when you take into account both ends of the ball. I thought he was really okay defensively in the series. I thought Brunson was much more of an issue for them. And Towns was the driving force behind most of the pivotal runs that the Knicks made in this series. So I think it's a little unfair to blame him as the main culprit for why they lost this series, because look, the guy averaged 25-12 and was one of the better players in terms of defensive rating when he was on the court in the series. So I think it's a little unfair. And in terms of other reasons why they, you know, couldn't get it done, Josh Hart, Mikal Bridges, Anunoby, Deuce McBride, these guys just didn't shoot the ball very well. OG was 29% in this series. Bridges was 35%. Hart was 18%. McBride, 31%. The four of them combined were 21 for 72. That's 29.5%. So sub 30 across the board for really the key swing guys for New York. And it was just asking a lot out of Brunson and Cat if those guys are going to shoot like that. It's just going to be an uphill battle. And it's not like they were terrible in all aspects of the game, but they were just kind of meh. You know, they didn't have any big, you know, swinging games. Like in the Boston series, OG drops almost 30 in game one. That was huge for them winning that series. Mikal Bridges has some huge fourth quarters in that series to help win some of those games late. Like, they didn't have any moments like that in this series. And so if they're not going to have those moments, it's just all going to fall on Towns and Brunson. And those guys are being asked to do a lot, and they're not competing defensively on the other end like they need to. So you're forced to play a lot of one-way lineups, which I think was just kind of the downfall for this team. Mitchell Robinson also was neutralized a bit just because of Indiana's pace. I felt like when he's out there, they have to play a little slower, and he attacks the offensive boards, and so they don't get back on defense as well. And they just totally took advantage of that. You know, his minutes were fine most of the time, but he was not the X factor and huge impact guy that he was against the Celtics. And then the other scapegoat here that everyone's going to look to blame is Tom Thibodeau. And look, he did get out coached by Carlisle. There's no way around that. But I don't think that's saying a ton about Tibbs, because I think Carlisle's that good. I think almost everybody's been getting out coached by Carlisle. So that's not like some huge knock on Tibbs in this series. And I thought Tibbs was the better coach in the Celtics series, for example. So, and I do applaud him, because he did finally pivot on some of the things he's been so stubborn on with his philosophy. You know, he was willing to bench his guy Brunson down the stretch of some of these games when they were hot without him. They switched the starting lineup, which they had been riding all year long. They benched Hart in favor of Mitchell Robinson. They used some of their depth more. They expanded the rotation. Landry Shamet, DeLon Wright got more minutes. Even Precious Achiuwa got some time when there was foul trouble. And those guys were all hugely positive. Shamet was plus 16.5 in this series. Wright was a plus 9.4. And then Precious, in a lot lesser minutes, was a plus 32.7. So those guys were all positive. He pivoted away from Campaign, who he had been riding for most of the year. And I thought he also switched up some of the defensive coverages a little bit better throughout this whole postseason, you know, just doing some drops, some switching, just at least mixing it up, which he had not done a ton of during the regular season. But unfortunately, it's too little too late for him because he didn't experiment enough in the regular season to, you know, have some of these different lineups play together to know what the different combinations look like, because he just was so intent on playing his top guys through the entire season and waited till he was absolute back against the wall. No other choice but to try something new and throw something at the wall. And that's when he finally decided to switch it up. I also, unlike Carlisle, who I complimented for doing this, I don't think he right-sized his approach to his personnel well enough, you know, this whole year. I thought Bridges was majorly underused as an offensive weapon. We saw what he can do in the Boston series. They just didn't ask him to do that much. They put him more as a spot-up shooter as opposed to a guy who can handle the ball a little bit and take some pressure off Brunson. I even thought Towns was a little underused when he's playing with Brunson. I think he was plenty used in the non-Brunson minutes, but when they're out there together, sometimes Cat is just standing out there as a spot-up guy, and I think they need to get more action with those two. You know, the Boston series, Towns was basically unstoppable in the post. They couldn't guard him there at all, but they just didn't go to that very often. And then you see this Indiana series, when he gets downhill, no one could guard him. But when Brunson's out here, they don't really run that very much either. And so, I think Tibbs will be back, but I would understand if they moved on. But the thing is, like, then who's the guy? Who are you hiring that's going to take this team for sure over the top? And I think that a lot of the problems with the Knicks are unfairly put on Thibodeau. I'm not always just a fire the coach guy. I don't think Thibodeau's a perfect coach. I think he's got a lot of flaws. But the reason they lost this series, the reason they haven't been able to get over the hump, a lot of them are just inherent flaws for this roster. And I think this roster just has inherent flaws that any coach would have to deal with. And it's not something you can necessarily scheme around. I mean, their two best players are walking liabilities on the defensive end. It's possible to hide one guy on defense in a playoff series, but it's really hard to hide two when 40% of your lineup are guys that you don't want guarding the ball, that you don't want guarding impactful, dynamic offensive players. It's really hard to avoid that because it's so easy to get at least one of those guys in the action, because it's likely that they're going to be guarding at least one guy that can, you know, make something happen on the offensive end. And so the numbers bear that out, because in this series, they were a plus 10 in Towns minutes with Brunson on the bench. They were a minus 5.6 with Brunson in and Towns out, which obviously is not great, but they were a minus 8.4 when they shared the court. So really not good when they are both out there. And then if you look at the playoffs as a whole, they were a plus 5.5 with Towns only on the court, a plus 1 with Brunson only on the court, and a minus 3.4 with them both on. So the whole postseason, they were just not good. They were consistently getting outscored when they were both on the court, and it all comes back to their defense, because those guys, they just aren't physically good enough to be able to guard and compete consistently on that end of the court. And so it just puts them in a really tough position, because that's their two best guys. Those are their two best offensive players by a mile. And so you just don't ever want to be in a roster situation where you feel like you have to stagger your two best players. You want your two best players to complement each other, to bring the best out of each other. And that's just not what has happened. Even offensively, like on paper, it seems like a really nice fit, but it feels like Cat, like I mentioned, is underutilized when Brunson's out there, and they obviously can't hold up defensively. And so that is a huge thing with this team, that I don't know if that problem's going anywhere, regardless of who the head coach is. And we've seen Towns have this issue, you know, by himself, even with Minnesota, but then you throw Brunson in the mix and it becomes increasingly difficult. I also think their playing style is just not very sustainable. And again, you could say, why doesn't Coach Tibbs, you know, switch things up? But I just think he's fitting the system to his best player. And Brunson just is a heliocentric guy. He's an isolation guy. He's a guy that's best with the ball in his hands. And so that's the offense they run. But I just think it's too much isolation. It's too much relying on one high usage guy. He was a 34% usage in this series, which isn't crazy, but it's still pretty high. There's only been 8 players in NBA history that have made the NBA finals with a usage rate that high for an entire postseason. And half of those instances are LeBron, Kobe, and Jordan. So it's like you really need to be like an all-time great to be able to sustain that level of usage and still make it far. And I'm not sure Brunson is quite there. And aside from just the Brunson cat fit, you know, their starting five unit that they switched up in this series has been negative for a huge sample. They were a minus 6.2 net rating in the playoffs in 335 minutes. That's their lineup of Hart, Bridges, Anunoby, Brunson, and Towns. A minus 6.2. And then in the regular season from January 1st on, they were a minus 1.4 net rating. So that is over 5 months, over 800 minutes, they were a negative lineup. And so that comes back to, that's a talented group. You have to wonder if the pieces just don't fit super well together. And I don't think it's some awful, awful coaching job by Tibbs. I think a lot of it is just this roster is flawed. Unfortunately, they're very talented, but there are just, it's really difficult to build around two guys that you don't want on the court during your best defensive possessions. And so moving forward, there's two ways to look at this team. You know, the positive angle as well. This was the best Knicks season this century. 51 wins was the second most since 2000, with 54 they had back in 2013 when they lost second round. But then they made the Eastern Conference Finals for the first time since 2000 also. And so they really had no business beating Boston like they did. And they had a wildly successful season if you just take a step back. These should be absolutely wide open next year. Tatum's going to be out for the year. Dame's going to be out for the year. Giannis is totally in limbo with his position with Milwaukee. Huge question marks around the Sixers and Embiid. Is he ever going to be healthy again? The Magic are still super young. And the Cavs, while they should be back on paper, they have proven to not be able to get over the hump in the postseason. And so as far as I'm concerned, unless they make some changes, they are frauds until proven otherwise. So the East is wide open. It's going to be a bad conference. So on paper, in theory, you know, the Knicks should be right there as either the favorite or at least one of the favorites. But on the negative hand, you can say, look, like I mentioned, this roster, it is inherently flawed. Those flaws are not going anywhere, no matter who the coach is, no matter what fringe players you bring onto the roster. When you're built around those two guys, it's just there are going to be defensive issues. And they have no way to even really improve on the margins. You know, they have no tradable first-round picks. They are right up against the second apron, so that they really have no space to sign anybody. And they have a very thin roster. So unless they trade one of their core guys, they're not going to be able to get, you know, two extra very solid rotation players to add to this group, which is kind of what they need because of how thin they are. I mean, they basically a seven-man rotation, but with Robinson's health, you know, concerns, it's hard to even say that they have a reliable seven. And another negative way to look at this is that this was a golden opportunity for them, and they still couldn't get it done. They had pristine health this time around. You know, last year they were decimated, and all the other teams got hurt last year, and a lot of teams got hurt this year too, but the Knicks did not. They were fully healthy. They got an entire healthy postseason, three rounds out of Mitchell Robinson. They got an entire season of health out of OG Anunoby. I mean, these are guys that like consistently are missing 20, 30 plus games per season. Robinson, this is the first time he's made through a postseason healthy in his career. So to think that they're going to be able to replicate that health again, of course, you can never assume injury, but they're going to have to get pretty lucky to have that again. I'm just saying that with especially the spike in injuries we've had, especially in the postseason and the NBA in recent years, like I don't know if they're going to be this healthy. All it takes is one hamstring strain from Anunoby and they're just cooked. They're not making the finals. All it takes is one rolled ankle from Mitchell Robinson and suddenly they're playing Precious Achiuwa 25 minutes as their backup center with Towns as the only reliable center who can't play defense. So there's a lot of reasons to say like they still couldn't get it done this year with Boston out of the picture, Cleveland out of the picture, Giannis out of the picture, Embiid out of the picture. Like all of those guys were non-factors in making the finals this year, and they still couldn't make it happen. So you can really look at it in either way. I think this core is like pretty close. I just think they need to add a couple more pieces. I think they need another reliable center that they can play. I think just one more other wing some depth there behind Anunoby and Bridges, because they really don't have any depth at the wing spot. And then, you know, I think if some things break their way, they could be right there in this spot again next year and even making the finals potentially with how bad the East is going to be. But I worry that they're going to make some panic trade. So we'll see. But I also just want to call out that, like, they've made flawless moves across the board over the last few years, except for the Mikal Bridges trade, which has just completely handcuffed them, because they had been hoarding picks, ready to pounce on a big move, and they were just a little bit too impatient, because now they could be in prime position to get Giannis potentially. If they had all their picks, you know, four picks in Towns, that's one of the best offers out there. But now with no picks, they're going to have to get creative just to be able to put even like a semi-competitive offer together, which, again, they could easily get beat by most teams. So I just think they kind of botched their asset management over the last year with that Bridges trade, because now I just don't see any path for them to get Giannis. I know that that's been rumored a little bit, but I just don't see it. I don't think the assets are there. Even if you told them that was his first option, I just don't think that they could get him. But the thing is, if they had those picks and they did get him, they would be runaway favorites in the East. And so they just, 1 year too early, went for, I think, the wrong guy. And I think it's really going to come back to bite them. But whatever they do moving forward, the next move has to be the right move. Because whatever their next move is, if they decide to move Kat for like a Kevin Durant, if they decide to run it back and just move on the edges, like, regardless of what they do or don't do, it's going to be highly scrutinized and really define this era of Knicks basketball, because they probably have a 2-year window. And I know everyone's like, oh, only 2 years. They got everyone locked up. We just saw with Boston how quickly windows can close. I mean, look at all the contenders of the last few years. How many of them are still contenders? Denver can't get out of the second round. Phoenix is a total mess. Sixers, total mess. Milwaukee's going to have to trade Giannis. Like, all the prototypical contenders we've had over the last few years are just not there anymore. And so windows close fast. This is probably a 2-year window from now with the Knicks. And so whatever they do, it's got to be the right move to maximize the next couple of years before they get in second apron hell. And before, you know, some of these guys start to get older, because they're all 28, 29 plus in their core right now. And so this is the time for them to make something happen. So we'll see if they can do it. Then moving out west, we have the Oklahoma City Thunder also moving on to the NBA Finals after making pretty light work of the Western Conference outside of a few games against the Nuggets, which obviously did go to a Game 7, but, you know, that Game 7 was never really in question. But they did knock off the Minnesota Timberwolves in only 5 games. This is a pretty quick and not very close series, kind of as I predicted. You know, I didn't think Minnesota really had the firepower to be able to overcome Oklahoma City's stout defense, but they won this very handily. And this is a team that had a +6 net rating in the series despite losing a game by 42 points, which is very hard to do. If you take out Game 3, the game that they did lose by 40 plus, then they were a +18.5 net rating for the rest of the series. So it was really domination by Oklahoma City outside of the one game, which we've talked about this. This is the same thing that happened with Indiana and New York. When you get these situations where a team is down 0-2, they often will play with an increased level of desperation to avoid going down 0-3, because once you're down 0-3, the series is essentially over. And so I'm sure they had the adrenaline running, and I'm sure Oklahoma City was probably a teensy bit complacent, because they were like, we got 2 in the bag already. We don't need this one. We can win Game 4 and still make light work of the series, which is exactly what happened. So, but to put it quite frank, these teams are simply just not on the same level. They're not. Oklahoma City is a clear step, if not 2 steps above where Minnesota is right now. And they won this series how they have won all year long, off the strength of their elite, all-time good defense. This is really shaping up to be one of the best defenses in the history of the league. And I do not say that lightly. That is really how good they've been. During the regular season, they were 8 points better than the league average defensive rating-wise. That is top four all time. In the postseason, they are a 7 points better than the playoff league average in defensive rating. Don't have the stats for where that ranks, but it's obviously quite good considering it's pretty close to where they were in the regular season. So they've continued that dominance throughout their postseason run as well, and it was on display in this series as well. And the number one way they're able to be so good defensively is by forcing so many turnovers. They have had a historically good turnover differential this season, and it continued in this series. Round one, they forced 77 turnovers to only 42 themselves. That's 19 a game that Memphis had. Round two, it was 124 to 78. That is 18 a game that they forced. And then in this series, it was 87 to 68. That's 17 that they forced. So in the playoffs to this point, they have forced 288 turnovers, and they have turned the ball over themselves only 188 times. So that is 100 extra possessions they've had across only 16 games. So that is an overwhelming number that is going to be very hard for other teams to overcome. I mean, in the postseason, they're averaging 18 forced turnovers a game to only 11.8 themselves. So that is 6 to 7 extra possessions every single game. And that gives you such a crazy margin for error. You have such a cushion with your shooting. You know, a bad shooting night, shooting variance just won't affect you the same way because you don't have to outshoot your opponent. All you have to do is shoot about as well as them. You can even shoot a little bit worse than them. And it doesn't matter because you just have so many more possessions volume-wise that you're going to be able to, off quantity, still be able to match them, if not outscore them alone from that. And this defense really just had the entire Timberwolves team in hell. I mean, that's how I can't think of any other way to describe it. It was like Ant's enthusiasm was totally killed to the point where he was uninvolved in some of these games. Julius Randle looked totally broken across a couple of these games. He got some garbage time buckets in some of them, but like he just looked like a shell of what he did in the first two series, rather predictably. They made Rudy Gobert look useless out there, unplayable, just a big body. That's pretty much all he was. He had such little impact on this series. They essentially made Mike Conley look like he needed to retire because physically they were so overwhelming to him and really everybody on this team, the way they swarmed the Wolves on the defensive end. And I think a big reason why the Wolves looked so vulnerable compared to the first two rounds where they won both of those series in five games is because they didn't have a size advantage like they did in the first couple rounds. I mean, they played the Lakers and the Warriors in the first two rounds. The Lakers, whose starting center was Jackson Hayes, and they didn't trust him, so they were essentially playing Rui Hachimura, LeBron, or Dorian Finney-Smith at the five. Zero rim protection whatsoever. Then the Warriors, I mean, Draymond Green, essentially their starting center. They played some Trace Jackson Davis minutes, Quentin Post, Kevon Looney, like still zero rim protection across the board. And so Randle could bully his guy and had nobody on the backside waiting for him. And in this series, that was not the case at all. But just another reason why they were able to do this so easily is just because SGA, I don't think there was much debate about who the better player is between him and Ant right now. I mean, he won the MVP this season. He was runner-up last year, won the scoring title, and had one of the all-time great guard seasons this year. But the gap between those two was so apparent in this series in particular. SGA averaged 31 points, 8 assists, 5 rebounds. He dropped 40 points in probably what was the most important game in game 4 that swung the series and put the Thunder up 3-1. He is just so constantly in control offensively. He gets to his spots basically better than anybody else, at least better than any other guard in the league. And he makes his shots when he gets to his spot better or as well as anybody else in the league as well. And he just makes it look easy. I mean, it's just like it's never difficult with him. He's so consistently efficient. He gets to the line, as we all know. Some people might argue a little too much. But the reason he's able to get to the line is because the dude lives in the paint. He lives in the paint. That is where he makes his money. It's his bread and butter. And it is his superpower as a guard to be able to get downhill so consistently and finish in the paint. And that drawing fouls just comes with that. And so he was spectacular in this series, continues to prove that he was the MVP this year. No slight to Jokic. Again, I stand by that he was a very worthy candidate, but I just thought SGA this year, with what this team has done, with him leading the charge offensively, he is so deserving, and he's backed it up in the postseason as well. Then, probably the biggest question mark for the Thunder coming into the postseason, and still some open question marks after that series against the Nuggets, was Jalen Williams, who had, you know, four or five really bad games in the last round. A couple good games here and there, but not the type of performance that really was alleviating your doubt. I know he had a big game seven, but still, you know, they probably wouldn't even have had to get to seven if he had shown up in some of those other games. But I feel like he grew up a little bit in that Nuggets series because he was awesome in this round. I mean, he was way more consistent, and he had his absolute best game at the perfect time. You know, that game four that I mentioned previously with SGA, he had 34 points on 13 to 24 shooting. And it's easy to have a good game when you're up 20 plus points and, you know, everybody's getting theirs. But in the clutch time, crunch time games, those are where you really make your money and have to have your biggest performances and able to win if you want to go on to be an NBA champion. And Jalen Williams was just phenomenal in that game. He was spectacular in the fourth quarter. He was, I mean, they don't win that. If he makes two less shots, they probably don't win that game. And so he was a huge swing piece in that game. And he stepped up in a way that they needed to, and in a way that a lot of people have doubted if he really could do so. And look, he wasn't great in game three, but nobody for the Thunder was. I mean, even SGA only had 14 points in that game. But if you take game three out, then in this series, Jalen Williams had 25 points a game, 7 rebounds, 5 assists on 51% shooting and 48% from three. So he was awesome. He was just really, really good in this series, and there's really no other way to say it. And I thought he played the part of the true number two that they've needed out of him to get over that hump. And here they are in the NBA Finals because of it. Chet Holmgren, he's still yet to have like a really, really good playoff series, just in a way where like he hasn't had any like 22 point per game averages, 10 rebounds, anything like that. But he was still really solid in this series, and I thought it was probably his best series that he has had. I mean, 18.6 rebounds, 57% from the field, 37% from three. They're not asking him to be anything more than a third option, but he is thriving in that role. And it's a lot easier for him to thrive in that role when J-Dub is thriving in his number two role. And I think some of the disconnect on maybe Chet not being where he needs to be sometimes is because Jalen Williams isn't doing what he needs to do as a number two. So then it puts Chet in a situation where there's pressure on him to be like the number two, essentially, but he's still only performing as a number three. But in this series, you know, he did everything he needed to, and he has been such a weapon for them. They've just been doing this strategy of putting him on sort of the weak link of the offense and have him as sort of a roamer, the way that the Wolves have done with Gobert in the past when Cat was guarding centers. They put Chet on McDaniels for the majority of this series, and it's not like McDaniels isn't a threat. You know, he's a decent offensive player, but he's not a creator. He lives in the corner, and even when he does score and attack the basket, it's normally off of gloves out in the corner. So it's not like he is, you know, running the pick and roll. They don't really involve him much in screen actions at the top. So it just played right into what OKC wanted to do. And Chet was able to continue to be that roamer, that was essentially just the rim protector waiting there for any guy that gets beat off the dribble. Then the Caruso, Dort, and Cason Wallace trio continues to just be awesome. I mean, especially defensively, they are just difference makers. To have one or two of those guys out on the court at all times, it makes it really difficult for these perimeter players, especially guards like Anthony Edwards in this series. And they've done just enough offensively, you know, especially Caruso has shot it really well from three in these playoffs. He was 41% again in this series. And so that trade just continues to look like such a win-win. I'm a giddy guy. I still contend that the Bulls did well for themselves, but I don't mean that to say that the Thunder didn't clearly also win their side of the trade. You know, I think this is a true win-win. And I think Caruso has been waiting to be on a team like this, to have playoff moments like this. He's been built for it. He's been locked away in the mediocrity of Chicago, but now he's finally getting the opportunity to show it. And he's a winner, and he's got championship pedigree, and he continues to just be super high impact despite more modest stats. Then Isaiah Hartenstein, he honestly, I mean, he played less than 20 minutes per game in the series. It's not that he was bad. They just didn't really need him for this matchup. And that's part of why they went out and got him, is to be able to be malleable. You know, you look at a matchup like Denver where he was pivotal because they needed his big body to be able to guard Jokic, because Chet just wasn't going to be up to that matchup physically, and they don't really have anybody else that can bother Jokic. But then you look at this matchup and Gobert's not really a threat. They pretty much played him to a point where he was ineffective and wasn't getting big minutes and not having much of an impact. So Hartenstein wasn't as important to this series just because of that. Obviously, I mean, still played 19, 20 minutes a game. So it's not like he wasn't playing at all. But the point is, like, that's what makes this team so great, is they're so versatile. Matchup to matchup, they can play differently. They can go with the two bigs. They can go with five out with Chet at the five. Like, they have so many different options they can throw at you. And so it's just such a luxury to be able to say, you know what, this our big free agent acquisition, $28 million a year player who has been awesome all year for us, we don't really need to play him 20 minutes in this series. But that's just how good and how deep this team really is. And then credit to Mark Daigneault too, because he made a little bit of tweaks in this series. You know, last series, Aaron Wiggins and Jalen Williams were getting the majority of the end rotation minutes. This series, it was more Isaiah Joe and Kenrich Williams. But that's the luxury of having a D team. You know, you can pick and choose depending on the matchup. Like I just said, they did that again. Wiggins just wasn't effective in this one. Joe got a little more run after really not playing at all last series. And then Jalen Williams was a huge factor against Jokic, giving them good minutes there. But again, they just didn't need the big body type in this one. They needed more versatile wings, which is why Kenrich Williams was a better fit for this series in this matchup. But I've already alluded to this a little bit, but I thought game four was where this series really got won. Every other game was not really competitive, pretty much not in doubt by the fourth quarter, but game four was the only close game, and Oklahoma City ended up winning it 128-126. And that was the kind of game that I'm not really sure that the Thunder would have won it last year. I'm not even really sure they would have won it early in that Nuggets series. But because they've had more experiences and these guys are getting more comfortable, more confident in their role, and just as a team, they were able to pull it out. Because that whole fourth quarter was so back and forth, and it was between like 1 and 7 points basically the whole time. They were trading buckets every time. One team would hit a shot, the other one would also hit a shot. And so it was the Thunder could not create separation, but the Wolves also could not take the lead. So it was very, very fun fourth quarter, one of the better games of the postseason. And it's honestly a credit to the Thunder, because look, the Wolves had a better field goal percentage, a better three-point percentage, more threes made, more free throw attempts, more free throws made, more rebounds, more assists, and less fouls, and they still lost the game. It is so incredibly hard to accomplish all of that and still not win a game. And the reason that the Thunder were able to still win is, you guessed it, the turnover battle, because they had such a discrepancy there. I mean, the Wolves had 23 turnovers compared to Oklahoma City's 14. So that's 9 extra possessions. As a result, OKC had 11 more field goal attempts. And that's exactly what I was saying earlier, is that their margin for error is just on another level compared to these other teams. There's so many teams in this postseason that they have an off shooting night and they can't win. They will not win ugly, low scoring games. But Oklahoma City, it's like they can have their opponent have a fantastic offensive night and they're still able to pull these games out, because they just off sheer volume are getting more looks. And 11 more field goal attempts, I mean, all you got to do is basically match their shooting and then make 3 of those 11, and boom, that's the game right there. And that's basically what happened in this. And the Wolves made more than enough shots to win this game. I mean, they were going into the fourth down only 5, and they scored 38 in the fourth. You'd think that would be enough to be able to overcome a 5-point deficit. And they got great performances from the role guys in this one. I mean, McDaniels had 22 on 3-6 from three. Nickeil Alexander-Walker had 23 on 5-8 from three. Dante DiVincenzo had 21 on 5-8 from three. So those guys had 66 points combined on 13-22 from 3-point range. So you'd like to think you're going to win most of those games where you get those kind of performances out of the role guys. But again, Oklahoma City was just so relentless with hitting big shots. Every time the Wolves would cut it to two or three, the Thunder would just hit another big shot and they would continue to keep them at arm's length. And that was really a microcosm of this series and why Oklahoma City is just on another level from Minnesota. And now that the Thunder have officially made the finals, they are really putting themselves in position to be one of the all-time great NBA teams. And I've kind of been tracking this all year. You know, I did some late season segments about how they're not being talked about enough as a potential all-time team just based on their net rating and their record. I mean, they won 68 games in the regular season. They were 16 games better than the 2 seed in the West. They had the 5th best record ever. In terms of net rating, they were plus 12.8, which was the 2nd best net rating of all time. Like, all the numbers bear them out as this true juggernaut team that was up there with any of the all-time teams you could put them up against. And the postseason has pretty much bared that out as well. I mean, if you just look at their home games in the playoffs, their margin of victory is 24.5 points per game. They have a plus 24.7 net rating. They're holding teams to a 97 offensive rating. Like, they are so devastating at home. They're 8-1. Their only loss was that weird Nuggets game one where they should have won. They were out double digits all fourth quarter. And then they just mis-executed on the foul up three strategy and it cost them. And there was some fluky stuff in that game. But they have just it's been not a contest in any of their other home games. they've been so dominant. And they now are 80-18 on the entire season if you just include their record from the playoffs and the regular season. And there's only been 7 teams, the Thunder included, to win 80-plus games and have 20 or less losses. Of course, the Thunder could still lose 2 games and they would not be in this group anymore. But as it currently stands, they are one of 7 teams. That the group includes the 72 Lakers, the 86 Celtics, the 96 Bulls, the 97 Bulls, the 2016 Warriors, and 2017 Warriors. The 16 Warriors obviously did not win their ring. So if we want to chop them out and say, well, they didn't get a championship, they're not going to be included in one of the all-time great teams. But that means that there's only 5 other teams outside this Thunder team that have won the championship with 80-plus wins and 20 or less losses, which, as far as I'm concerned, that puts you in the legitimate debate for greatest team ever. I'm not saying this team is the greatest team ever. I'm just saying that that's the type of teams that they're in the conversation with right now. And I think we have just undersold them all year because obviously they had never even made a conference finals. They're the youngest team in the NBA. There were still a lot of question marks with their youth and stuff like that. But, and all that's fair. But it still just cannot go unnoticed. Like, if they win the finals, they'll have 84 wins, which would be tied for the 3rd most ever in a season. The only teams to have 84 or more wins in a season, regardless of how many losses you have, are the 96 Bulls, 97 Bulls, and 2016 Warriors. Which, again, that era of the Warriors and that era of the Bulls are highly regarded as the 2 greatest cores, groups, teams of all time. And that's just how good the Thunder have been. So any of the doubters, look, I don't really know what else you want this team to do besides win the championship, which it looks like we're trending that direction at this point, because they've just been so unbelievably great this year. Moving to the Wolves side of things, this is now 2 straight Western Conference Finals appearances and 2 straight kind of ass kickings, if we're being honest. I mean, it happened a little bit differently both years. Last year, they were in every game. They had these clutch time games against Dallas and Luka just cooked them. He cooked them late in the games and they didn't show up in crunch time and they found themselves down 3-0 and they end up losing in 5 games and they got blown out on their home court in game 5 at the hands of Luka. This year, they got blown off the court most of these games. You know, obviously they had the one close game four and then they win game three, but it's kind of the reverse where the Dallas series, they had one blowout and a bunch of close losses. This series, they had one close loss and a bunch of blowouts. So regardless, either way, they got thoroughly outplayed in both series. And they are a really good team, but clearly to me are just not close to the level they need to be a legitimate contender. I've been complimentary of the Wolves all year, especially in this playoff run. You know, I picked them to beat the Warriors in five, and that was with when I thought Steph was playing. So I clearly think very highly of them. But again, they just are not in the same discussion, the same breath as this Thunder team, for example. And in this series, a lot of that started with Anthony Edwards. He is obviously a very special player. I think I would go as far as to put him as high as the sixth best player in the league, and with an opportunity to jump into the top five over the next few years, depending on how those play out. And he has proven to be a big-time postseason performer. I mean, he knocked out Kevin Durant, Devin Booker last year, then knocked out Nikola Jokic. This year, he knocks out Luka Doncic and LeBron James. Then, I mean, knocks out Steph's team. I know Steph didn't play, so it's not really fair. But regardless, this dude has not been afraid of anybody, and he will continue to not be. But his two worst series by far have been the two Western Conference Finals. Once he's gotten to this point, he just looks a little human after looking superhuman in some of these other series. And this year, only 23 points per game in this series, only 28% from three-point range after really having one of the best high-volume three-point shooting seasons ever this year. And only 23 assists to 16 turnovers, so not very good as a playmaker across the board. His usage rate was only 26.6%, which not super high. I know I go on my soapbox about not wanting dudes to have too high of a usage rate, but I also don't want them too low. Like, if you're Anthony Edwards, I want you around the 30 range. You know what I mean? It's not like he's majorly below there, but it just shows that he was a little uninvolved in some of these games in a way that was kind of alarming if you watched it, because it's not just that he was uninvolved. It's how it looked. Like, I'm okay with lesser stats, but it's how it happened. And he looked a little dejected at times, and he just sort of like accepted that he was getting locked up. When he would get doubled or they were face guarding him and he had to pass away, he wasn't, there was no sort of cutting, no coming off screens, no making the defenders work off the ball. He kind of just stood out there on the perimeter and accepted that, hey, well, I'm getting double covered, so I'll let the other guys do their thing. Like, it's just, I've heard people say this, like Zach Lowe, talk about how it was a little Harden-esque. And obviously, like, we don't mean that he's performed in the playoffs like Harden has. That's a little insulting, to say the least. But just the lack of involvement when he doesn't have the ball. And that's just not a winning formula. You know, you don't see a lot of other star players make it very far when they are just standing around watching, when they don't have the ball in their hands. And the Wolves were a better team offensively in this series when he was off the court than without. They had 106 offensive rating with him on the court and 130 with him off. So they were way better when he was off the court than when he was on, which is a little concerning because it's not, I mean, I know the Wolves have a good bench, but so does Oklahoma City. You know, I don't really see any reason for why they should be worse with him off the court. And so this was just really not a good showing from Ant. Again, this doesn't lessen my opinion of him. These teams were completely not on the same level, as I've said a couple times. I didn't expect them to be, you know, really in this series, but I just would have liked to see a little bit more care from Ant in some of these possessions where he was not, you know, the focal point of it. Then on the Randall side of things, I mean, he was spectacular in the first two rounds. There's really no way around it, but I touched on this earlier, but a lot of that I think was because he was feasting on smaller players. They just didn't have the size to be able to contain him because they were playing small ball and there was no rim protection after the first line of defense. And so he was able to kind of just do his thing and play some bully ball and get to the basket pretty much whenever he wanted. But I think we all knew that wasn't going to work against this team, this kind of defense with these many options and this kind of size. And they had Jalen Williams as the main guy guarding him. You know, he saw some Caruso. There were some other guys at different times. But as I mentioned, they had Chet helping as the roamer, the weak side rim protector. And not to mention that, but the guards that I talked about, Caruso, Dort, Wallace, like, they're just sitting there ready to pounce as soon as he puts that ball on the floor on the low blocker out the elbow. Like, there were so many times where he would start dribbling and you would just be like, dude, look behind you, because you knew that there was a soft double coming, and he just turned the ball over like crazy. I mean, this was New York Knicks playoff Julius Randle. He looked like he quit at times. He had more turnovers than assists in the series. He had 6 points on 2-for-11 in game two, 5 points on 1-for-7 in game four. And it was just, it was a stinker performance. And it's the kind of thing that we've kind of come to expect from Julius Randle. Again, no disrespect to him for his first two rounds. He was awesome. But the question remains, can you win 4 straight playoff rounds with a guy like him when he is so susceptible to these kind of performances? It just puts yourself in a tough spot when you know that at any moment he can basically implode and become a huge negative to the team. Then they finally did get some good shooting performances from the role guys. I mean, McDaniel shot 42% from three. Na was 41%. DiVincenzo was 44%. But it really didn't matter because the top two guys were so inconsistent. And then the other two starters just looked totally overmatched. I mean, Conley looked old as hell in this series. He had 4 points per game, 21% from the field, 29% from three. He looked every bit of his 38, 39, however old he is. And just to put it into perspective, he had 22 total points in this series in 113 minutes, as opposed to Kenrich Williams, who in 45 minutes had 21 points. So basically almost three times as few minutes and basically scored the same amount of him. And he's not even remotely a focal point of the offense. And meanwhile, Conley is the main ball handler for Minnesota. So he was just physically overmatched. And I don't know if he's the kind of guy that you're going to be able to throw out there in these kind of series where it's this physical with these youth and athleticism on the defensive end from the Thunder, because Conley, like, he still is a high IQ guy and does some things well, but Father Time is certainly catching up. And then Gobert was essentially unplayable in this one. You know, I mean, you look at 6 points a game, 7 rebounds, only managed 26 minutes a game, even only 52% from the field. This is a guy who shot like in the mid 60s in his prime. Like, so he, we know he's not a good finisher, but he was rendered very ineffective in this series. And then Naz Reid really was pretty disappointing in this series as well. Did not play well, really showed his limitations. And I'm not gonna say lost him money. I'm sure he's still gonna get a very handsome payday this offseason, but you know, it definitely showed to me that he's probably best in this sort of swing hybrid role where he's not a 37, 38 minute per game full-time starter, but we'll see if that ends up being his role after he signs somewhere, whether it be with Minnesota or somewhere else. But overall, Oklahoma City's defense just made this team look incompetent offensively at times. They just could not take care of the ball, and it was just an uphill battle from there. I mean, 17 turnovers a game is just not going to get it done. You cannot lose the possession battle that badly. But moving forward for the Wolves, there are a lot of question marks for them because Nickeil Alexander-Walker, Naz Reid, Julius Randle are all unrestricted free agents. Randle technically could still return. He has a player option for about $30 million. So it's so funny how those things work. You know, at the end of the regular season, I'm sure everybody was like, oh, he's definitely picking that up. But then after the first two rounds, they're like, oh, well, he's definitely declining now. And it's like, who knows what he's going to do? I could see either way. I would think he would opt out just to get the longer term security, even if he was making, you know, slightly less than that amount. I think he could get at least $30 million on the open market just when you look at what some of these other guys are getting. I don't know what kind of team will be interested in him because he's such a unique kind of polarizing player. And maybe it's Minnesota. I could see that just because if they do let him walk for nothing, it also just makes the Towns trade look that much worse. They basically get 1 year out of Randall and then DiVincenzo and one first round pick. It's just, you know, not exactly a haul. But they probably are going to lose at least one of these guys, because the main motivation for the Towns trade was it was a money move. You know, they wanted to cut down on some salary. They're in the second apron. I'm sure they want to get under that going into this coming season. And so to pay all three of those guys, they'd be a lock to be in the second apron, because they would maybe all three get pay raises. Maybe not Randall. He might be around the same range, but for sure the other two are going to get raises, like no doubt about it. So bringing all three back would put them in the second apron. It would, I mean, put them in a worse place financially than they were when they had Towns. So I just can't imagine they're going to keep all three. I'm sure they're going to let at least one of them walk. I think probably their highest priority person to keep would be Naz Reid. He's obviously a huge, huge fan favorite, but I think they really believe in him. He's probably cheaper than Randall. And I think he's the guy they most want to keep. I think for Randall, they're probably very interested in keeping him at the right price. I'm sure they don't want to overpay him, but he's obviously pretty important to them because he's their clear-cut number two option. And without him, Ant is really just going by committee next to him. And then I feel like Alexander Walker is probably the most likely to walk. I think he'll have a pretty robust market, and I think they probably will let guys like Jalen Clark and Terrence Shannon kind of backfill him in that spot in the rotation. They at least have some internal options that could be viable to replace him, whereas with the other guys, they just don't really have that. But they clearly need to make some sort of upgrades if they want to get to where they want to be as a true contender with this team. I think that they need a lot more out of their guard spot. Conley averaging 4 points per game in a couple of these series, like, that's just not going to get it done. He is too limited at this point offensively as a scorer and shooter. And the Rob Dillingham trade, it's still early, but I won't say it's a disaster, but it is not looking good at this point. I mean, they gave up an unprotected 2031 pick swap for him, and he was largely unplayable for a lot of this season. I know he had some injuries here and there, but it's like, he's a small guard that doesn't defend. He's not a true point guard, but he can't really play off ball because of his size. So I think his ceiling as a player is like a sixth man, first guard off the bench, like energy scorer. But I do not feel confident that he'll ever reach a point where he can close playoff games and hold up defensively. I think he'll get targeted left and right just because of his size alone. So I don't necessarily see him as the point guard of the future. I think that would be a risky move going into next year. But again, I don't know if you can go into next year with Conley as the starter. I think you can. Conley as a backup is totally fine because I think he can still do a lot of things. But as the full-time lead guard, I don't know if I see it. Again, they don't really have a ton of resources to add around those guys. I mean, like I said, they've been a second apron team. The only tradable first round pick they have is the one they got from the Towns trade, which is Detroit's pick, which I think is like 18th overall or something like that, the back end of the teens, which if they don't trade before the draft, then it's no longer a pick that they can trade. You know, it's a player, but teams obviously are going to value a pick more than a player because that might not have been the player that they wanted to pick at that spot. So the clock's ticking on that being a tradable asset for them, at least at the same value that it's at now. And so the one move that's been floated, you know, they've been rumored to be interested in Kevin Durant. And I think that on paper, that's a good fit because they really do need a more consistent, reliable number two option. But I've just been skeptical on the logistics behind this because I'm not sure how this trade's going to work. Because like I said, they only have one pick to trade. If Randall doesn't opt into his deal, then you have to include either McDaniels or Gobert in a deal to make it work. Like, just from a money standpoint, one of those two has to basically be in it. And if you're giving up those guys, let's say you give up Gobert, like, I know he gets a lot of shit, but he's so integral to what they do defensively. And Naz Reid is a full-time five, unless you're going to like sign like a veteran minimum guy. Like, I do not love that for them in terms of their center rotation. We've seen how important that position has been over the last few years in the postseason. If you don't have a good playable center, it's hard to get far in today's NBA. And then McDaniels, I think they'd lose a lot of defense if they do trade him. And then if you get Durant, are you bringing Randall back? Like, I think that's kind of a clunky fit. So the thought is, if you get KD, then you probably are moving on from Randall. So then you're losing Randall and McDaniels, and then you're really thin at the wing spot. So I don't know if they're better at making that move. I also don't know if Phoenix, like, do they want Gobert? Is McDaniels and a first good enough for that? Like, it's just hard to know. And if Randall opts in, then presumably he's in the deal. And then it's what, DiVincenzo and Randall plus a first for Durant, which I think technically works. But if you're Phoenix, is that a good enough deal for you? I feel like they probably could do better than the 18th pick in the draft in Julius Randle. And DiVincenzo is a good player, don't get me wrong, but do they need another shooting guard? They already have Booker, Beal, and Grayson Allen, and then Royce O'Neal, who's a 6'4 wing as is. Like, add DiVincenzo to that, it's like so redundant roster wise. So they'd probably want to repackage him or one of the other guys anyway. So I don't know. I just don't think Randall on an expiring deal plus the 18th pick in the draft is really doing it for Phoenix, in my opinion. So we will see. I could be wrong, but I just feel like if they don't somehow get KD in a way that doesn't decimate their depth, and they lose one or two of the guys I mentioned, and they just don't have the means to sort of add another impact guy, I think they're probably going to take a bit of a step back before they take a step forward. I mean, this year was a little bit of a step back from last year, just because, I mean, they were in contention for the number one seed all of last season. This year, they end up as the sixth seed, just barely. They were in the play-in basically all season long. So we'll see where they go from here. And like I said, they very well may take a step back next year. But the thing is, Ant is only 23 years old, so there is a ton of runway for them to go through different iterations of this team. They're really expensive right now, so maybe they want to just kind of reset and reevaluate in a year, which sounds kind of silly to do when you have a guy as good as Ant, but it's not a crazy idea when you just look at his age and the timeline of some of the guys on this roster. But I don't think they're that close, and that's just how I feel. And I think that they're a move or two away. I don't think adding like if they add Tyus Jones to replace Mike Conley, as an example, I don't think that's getting them over the hump. I think they need a bigger, more impactful piece. I don't trust Randall as the number two option. I didn't love that trade when it happened for the Wolves. And so I preferred Towns as the two next to Ant. But the reality is they probably need somebody better than both of them to get to where they need to be to make the finals, or let alone win a championship. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. The NBA Finals are kicking off this Thursday, June 5th. So before then, I do intend to put out my official finals preview, where I'll obviously give my predictions. I'll talk through the most important swing factors for the finals, in my opinion, as well as, you know, do a little season recap on the two teams that are in the finals to say, how did we get here? And then I'll also do a little bit about ramifications for each team winning and what it could mean for them. But with that being said, thank you so much for listening, and I will chat with you soon.